This was the article that dealt with the dumbest people that you knew who suddenly became successful lawyers and this sort of thing.
That's right. The horror of being old enough to know people in charge of things.
That's right. Binky so-and-so back in college.
That's right.
The third dumbest guy in class all of a sudden is the most important defense lawyer.
That's right. Terrifying.
That's right.
People think what's depressing about going back to reunions is finding people who aren't successful, but it's finding people who are successful and knowing that you helped them through bonehead English and they are now the Under Secretary of State.
In fact, I probably was about the fourth dumbest kid in my college class, and today I happen to be president of the Ohio University Alumni Association.
That'll show those guys, right?
So people are saying, Swain, he was the third dumbest guy in the class.
Well, I actually could make a case for Ivy League colleges in the 50s that income is now precisely in inverse proportion to academic standing in the class. And I use that as a kind of a soothing balm to my classmates when I went back for my 25th reunion. This was at Yale, and I said, if this is true, which I'm certain it is, then those of you who have whose children have failed to get into Yale, I myself am too young to have children of college age, but some of them aren't. You can take heart, because if not absorbing a Yale education is the path to riches, think of what lies before someone who has no Yale education at all, and they'll probably rule the world.
It's amazing the number of writers who come out of the Ivy League colleges like Yale and Harvard.
I guess it's amazing, but I'm not so sure there isn't some kind of self-selection in there. I'm not so sure that it has that much to do with education they receive. It might, to some extent, but there's also the idea of who thinks about going there in the beginning, and in the sense that one of the reasons that income varies in inverse proportion to standing in the class is that part of the say lower third of the class are people who under another system probably wouldn't be there, and the reason they're there is because they're well off to start with, so basically they start off very well, so the statistics get skewered as far as the selection. I mean, who's starting out as well as who's getting educated.
Since your latest book is about food and eating and so forth, I want to ask you questions about that, but can you just for my own knowledge give me a sort of a nutshell history of yourself?
Sure. As I said, I went to Yale. I grew up in Kansas City, the heart of America, as we used to call it.
Which side?
Oh, the real Kansas City, Missouri. And used to be the gateway to the West before St. Louis built a $49 million gateway arch and claimed that title. Left Kansas City is the city of fountains. It's very embarrassing. And my father happened to read Dink Stover at Yale as a boy, and so I went to Yale. And after the Army and some odd jobs, I worked a time in the South in the Atlanta Bureau for a year, and then I was a writer for a while at time. As you know, there's separate functions, reporting and writing at time. And for a while, I was a floater, a person who went from section to section when people were sick or on vacation, and became instantly omniscient in religion one week and education the next week and show business the week after that.
That led to the rave reviews for the novel Floater.
Well, I did say in the novel that I acknowledged that I was the floater referred to who tried to get out of religion by writing alleged in front of any religious event of any questionable historical authenticity, like the alleged parting of the Red Sea and the alleged birth of Christ and that sort of thing. Didn't do me any good. They just crossed out the alleged.
I don't know. I did the same thing last week, because I'm kind of a floater too here. But I wrote I can't remember the name of the narrow pathway in the Arab quarter of Jerusalem that Christ allegedly trod on his way
right.
to the crucifixion,
right.
But nobody had any problem.
Nobody said anything at all. Nobody's standing there either, but they crossed it out. Then about 20 years ago, I went to the New Yorker, and I've been there ever since for the last 15 years, ending this last summer, I guess. I went around the country doing a series called U.S. Journal, did a piece every 3 weeks from somewhere in the country. 3 or 4 years ago, I started to do a column for The Nation, called On Civil Liberties, which is a column that I think the proper description is it's meant to be funny. I'm leery of saying it's a humor column or something like that, because that implies that people actually laugh, and since the Nation doesn't do very many readership surveys, it's very hard to tell whether they actually laugh or not. They haven't stoned the building yet. That's all I...
Nation's such a grim magazine, and all of a sudden I see your column in there, and it just stands out.
Well, it is very odd that, to have it there, and I it's really a result of having known the editor for many years, the person who took over, the wily and parsimonious Victor S. Novasky, who... He originally offered to pay me what he called somewhere in the high two figures for this column. We've got him up to what we call a century. We get a C note now for that call. And so having known Victor, I have the opportunity to have been exploited by left-wing magazines for a number of years.
You know Katha Pollitt?
Yeah.
I had her in a couple of weeks ago.
Well, it's a very pleasant crowd. And in fact, it's somewhat of the same group of people who years ago put out or didn't put out, depending on what you think of, a magazine called Monocle, which was a magazine of political satire. And my first experience with Novasky, that was the magazine that actually sent me a bill for a piece I gave them. They said it would cost more to process it than they intended to pay me, and they sent me a bill for the difference. So I've had long experience with that. Yeah, I often wonder what the subscribers of the Nation think when they read my column. I tell Novasky that I assume the subscription list is 1,400 librarians and 12 unreconstructed old Trotskyites out there somewhere. And I complained a few months ago that he was getting into public debate too often and that it was going to get back to Kansas City, my hometown, that I was working for a Pinko magazine. And everybody knows I write the column for The Nation, but my mother's been kind of letting on it's a tennis magazine, and that's been satisfying people in Kansas City for all these years. And I don't know what the subscribers think. I have a character in the columns recently called Harold the Committed, and someone asked me who that is, and I'm not exactly sure. I don't have anybody in mind, but I think of it as part of the subscription list of The Nation, Harold the Committed. He's the one who wanted my 10-year-old daughter to go to the Halloween parade dressed as Emma Goldman, the anarchist. She decided to go as a chocolate chip ice cream cone with chocolate sprinkles instead. So,
good decision.
Yeah, I thought it was a wise one. He wanted the other one to go as the danger posed by the military-industrial complex, and she went as an M&M. So we don't always take Harold the Committed's advice at our house.
Do you have an office? Do you work out of your home or what?
I have an office at the New Yorker.
Do you punch in every day?
Oh, no. No, I don't punch in very often. I really work at home, basically. I go to that office. I go less now since I don't do the U.S. Journal series. I used to go in a lot more to pick up my newspapers. I used to take a lot of weekly papers from around the country and to edit pieces. I go in there when we're closing a piece. But now that I'm doing longer pieces or other things, I don't go in as often. And I tend to work at home, which is nice. Coming uptown wears me out more than writing.
The New Yorker, the magazine that I've read off and on since I was a kid, it's such a strange magazine. I find myself, as I am looking at an article or fiction, I find myself flipping to the end to see who wrote it, to see if I want to read it.
Right. Well, it does have a table of contents now, I mean, which it didn't have when I first got there. I guess that table of contents went in, God, I'm guessing 10 or 12 years ago, I suppose, maybe longer than that. Although now it looks as if it's always been there, since it looks so much like the rest of the magazine. It is a strange magazine. It is a conservative magazine with a low C, the lowercase C conservative, in the sense that if you see a facsimile of the first issue, it hasn't changed an awful lot in makeup, and its values are about the same. I mean, they change gradually over the years, for instance, toward long fact pieces rather than relatively frivolous pieces about life in New York.
The ads are the same.
The ads are the same. But even as the New Yorker has changed, even though part of that change is the values that they've only had two editors, certainly William Shawn's values are implicit in the magazine. But on the other hand, it's a kind of a responsive magazine. That is, it responds to what the writers want to write. There's never been a meeting at the New Yorker, as far as I know. That is, nobody gets together and says, what should we be writing? It's almost the opposite of a trendy magazine, even though it's identified as that with the guy looking through the monocle, who I've always hated, that Eustace Tilley is. Years ago when Esky, remember when Esquire had that little man with the white mustache, they finally phased him out, and I thought it was a shame the New Yorker could have arranged some kind of suicide pact between Esky and Eustace Tilley. But despite Eustace Tilley, the New Yorker is in a way the kind of opposite of a trendy magazine. That is, the editor of the New Yorker more or less responds, and of course he can say yes or no, so that response is important, to what the writers want to do. So if people say, isn't the New Yorker more political now? Well, the answer is yes, but it's not because some people sat around saying, wouldn't it be better if we were more political? But you don't get very many writers coming up and saying, I'd really like to do a story on the National Horse Show in Madison Square Garden. They're more likely to say, I want to do a story on something more serious. So a lot of it just reflects the writers and the times. And if anybody sat around 5 years ago and said, what should we do a 4 or 5 part piece on, nobody would have said the possibility that the Earth is going to be destroyed by nuclear holocaust. So no meeting would have possibly produced Jonathan Schell's piece on the fate of the Earth, because I can't think of a less likely subject. Somebody would have sighed in the corner and said, oh God, not that again, haven't we done that? And nobody's interested in that, and nobody had heard of it for years. Everybody kind of accepted it. So in a way, what turns out in the New Yorker is unplanned in the sense that no great council of policy setters planning it, and that's why the magazine looks the way it does, and that's why it's unpredictable. So that I really didn't expect to pick the New Yorker up and find A. Alvarez, a man who I identify with suicide and with writing about suicide, writing a 2-part piece on the World Series of Poker in Las Vegas, which I loved. I mean, there are pieces I don't like in there, but that piece I really loved.
Did you see the new Vanity Fair?
Yes. In fact, I had a piece in the new Vanity Fair.
I must have missed that. It was so filled with material that I haven't read it all yet, and it was that thick, the first issue,
yeah.
And I was just puzzled. I was trying to go through it, trying to figure out if it had sections. Or
it doesn't. It didn't have sections, as far as I could tell. I'm disappointed because I thought my piece was one of the few pieces that could be easily found, since it was the first one. It was about why I hadn't been asked to subscribe. Apparently, I don't live in a postal zone that is august enough to be asked to subscribe, be asked to be part of what the letter referred to as a handful of select, intelligent, rich individuals, something like that. I think first issues are a terrible problem. I don't think any magazine looks very good, the first issue. One of the problems with it is that you're not used to seeing it. That isn't to say that I don't think that there were real design problems with the first issue of Vanity Fair. I really do. I mean, I thought there was a kind of a anti-reading design to it. That is, that I felt that the pieces that I read, some of which I really enjoyed, I was reading in defiance of the wishes of the person who put the magazine together, rather than according to his plan. I say his, I don't know who did all this. I mean, but if you look at the first issue of, say, The New Yorker, and this technically wasn't the first issue of Vanity Fair, but in a way it was. I mean, after all these years, not very many people who read it had ever seen Vanity Fair. I've never seen the original Vanity Fair. If you look at the first issue of The New Yorker, I don't think it's as embarrassing typographically. As I say, it looks pretty much the way The New Yorker looks now in some ways, but it's not a very uplifting issue of a magazine. It really
actually reminded me of Esquire in some respect.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Esquire is a magazine that I haven't read Esquire for a long time, but it used to be such a, I don't know what the phrase would be, maybe an inside magazine. It seemed to me that they were gearing all of their material toward their friends. And they were leaving me out somehow. I would read the magazine and say, who are they talking
That's
to?
That's a terrible danger in a magazine. The terrible danger of running a magazine that is meant to have people congratulate each other in certain bars in New York. And I don't know, I haven't read Esquire lately either, but when I say it wasn't terribly uplifting, I mean the original issue of The New Yorker wasn't terribly uplifting. In fact, I find it rather embarrassing to read that. I don't know if you remember when New York Magazine first came out, but it looked awful. Now, whatever you think of New York Magazine, it looks now pretty much the way it ought to look, it seems to me. And the first issue looked as if it was going to come off in your hands. It looked kind of like the New York Post. But I think one of the problems is that your eye isn't used to it. And the other problem is that the first issue of a magazine, particularly in this case of Vanity Fair, they seem to cram as much advertising as possible into the first issue. I don't know anything about the advertising part of it, so it's conceivable that advertisers simply want to be in the first issue and don't want to. That it's hard to sell the third issue compared to the first issue. I don't know about that, but
the second issue is about a third as big as.
Oh, I haven't seen the second issue, but I found things difficult to get involved in, which I think is a problem of makeup. And of course, writers have terribly selfish views about this. I mean, if someone said, "What do you think of the Atlantic?" or something, I said, or having a piece in the Atlantic, I think of partly as, are people likely to read it? Is it displayed in a way that people are likely to read it? Because particularly journalism doesn't exist unless people read it. I mean, I'm not writing my memoirs or anything like that for somebody to put in Time Capsule and say in the 21st century this was a thoughtful, interesting fellow. I'm writing things for people to read, and if people don't read them, it doesn't do me any good. There's no reason to write them, really, except to feed my children and send them to college, I hope. But if you say there are various magazines that I think of as writers' magazines, editors' magazines, designers' magazines, or art directors' magazines, and art directors' magazines are hard on writers. I mean, if for instance, you have a piece in a magazine that is one of those magazines that is all design, you get about three sentences of your piece, and then it says, continued on page 241. It's really unlikely anybody that you've grabbed somebody by the lapels hard enough to persuade them to turn to page 241 when there are all kinds of visual goodies between the start of the piece and there. So, in a way, writers are look out for writers, and in that way, I think most writers welcome Vanity Fair in the sense it's another market for writers. It's another place that is willing to pay premium rates for prose and for nonfiction and fiction, and not to treat it as something that has to fit into some sort of cubbyhole, which is fine for writers. So I think writers generally wish magazines well.
Well, that's a very good point, because outside of some of the little magazines, some of the scholarly journals, there aren't very many places to find sources of fiction today.
No, that's very true. And there's simply too much for, in a way, there are four or five magazines that run serious fictions that are of general circulation. And for a short story writer, the more the better. It's just simple as that. Particularly, the more the better for if the edition is actually going to pay a living wage or price for an article that is somewhat commensurate to the time the person took to do it.
Well, we could sit here and bat magazines around all day, but I'd like to get into some of the things that you write about in Third Helpings. I come from the real Midwest. I mean, you only come from Kansas City, Missouri, but I come from Wichita, Kansas. I think outside of eating, when I grew up as a kid, outside of eating freshwater fish that my father would catch in a freshwater lake someplace in Wisconsin and would clean that morning, and my mother would put cornmeal on and fry in a pan, I never ate fish, because in the late 1930s, 1940s, there was no refrigeration to speak of. So we didn't eat fish, and I never got to like it. But somehow, and I believe you said in Third Helpings, or maybe it was in an earlier book, American Fried, oysters seem to be very popular in the Midwest.
Yeah, I was surprised at that when I found we actually go on Christmas Eve to the home of some friends from South Dakota who serve oyster stew as a regional dish. And I met somebody once from northern Iowa who spoke of one of the memories of his childhood being going down into his uncle's basement where there would be a big tub of oysters. I suspect that it was because oysters kept better than most shellfish or most fish. As you say, I mean, when I first got to the East, although we had traveled some when I was a kid, I guess I was a kind of a hamburger-eating kid, but when I finally got to the East when I was growing up and I saw a clam, I thought it was some sort of prank. I mean, I thought somebody was playing a joke. And I don't remember oysters in Kansas City, but certainly they existed in the upper Midwest. And oyster eating doesn't have anything to do with nearness to the sea. And, of course, an oyster, and the old joke is think of the first person who ate an oyster. Of course, what a heroic person that was who thought this is something edible. And a lot of people still feel that way. When I went to the all-male oyster-eating dance that the volunteer fire department in Georgetown, Delaware holds every year, they told me a story of a particularly gullible fireman who was one of those people who couldn't imagine why anybody ate oysters or how anybody could eat oysters. They had persuaded him that a particularly foolhardy fireman was able to eat an oyster through his nose. And, of course, for somebody who doesn't eat oysters, that doesn't sound that much more unlikely than the ordinary way of eating oysters. And I think he might have believed them, even if they hadn't added what I thought were two brilliant touches of verisimilitude, that it had to be a small oyster, of course, and also he couldn't use Tabasco, else he'd sneeze. I think he would have accepted it anyway.
Do you remember the time that you ate your first fish?
Yeah, I remember eating French fried shrimp as a kid in Kansas City. But I think I was eating mainly the fry rather than the shrimp. And, of course, even now, it's not unusual in the United States, as you know, to be on a seacoast, push your way through a crowd of fishermen, get into the restaurant, find that all the fish is frozen from some other coast. I mean, I used to think that Alaska and Florida actually exchanged frozen fish, bland frozen fish, in the way that some countries exchange high school students, because it was just easier and you didn't have to worry about portion control and whether or not somebody caught something that day. So I'm not sure that fresh fish has been that prevalent even for people, say, who are now in their 20s and 30s, if they live on the coast.
You know, New York City is wedged between two rivers and an ocean, and you would think this would be a terrific place for seafood, and yet I look at New York and it doesn't seem like a seafood town.
No, it isn't. There's some good seafood restaurants in New York, but they're rare. I think good seafood restaurants are rare anywhere.
No, Baltimore. I worked in Baltimore for about 4 years, and I thought that was a wonderful seafood.
Baltimore has the feeling of a seafood place,
yeah.
Perhaps because of the crab, because it has this one special seafood delicacy that other people don't have, and it's made kind of a specialty of. But in general, if you take those Baltimore restaurants like Gordon's and O'Bricky's and Gundy's, those places where you break the crab with a little mallet and eat it on newspapers or butcher paper, that sort of thing certainly doesn't exist in New York, and not very many places. Boston isn't a great seafood town, even though there it is, right in New England fishing waters.
Baltimoreans have a prank that they use if they want to get even with their boss. They make sure that they eat crabs over the weekend. On Monday, they take the crabs in a paper bag to work with them. Before they go into the office, they take the hubcap off the boss's car, right? Put the crabs inside the hubcap, put it back on the wheel, and forget about it. Well, the boss doesn't forget about it because in about 2 days, he begins to smell something as he drives around. He doesn't know what to do. He washes the car. He puts deodorant in it. The only time he discovers the source of the odor is when he has a flat tire, and that could be months and months later.
Right. Is that how you happened to leave the Baltimore station?
There's another thing that Baltimoreans do I never saw before. I don't, if you were ever there for a festival or something, they give you crab cakes on a stick, like eating an ice cream
yes.
cone on a stick.
I had that once when I went to the Baltimore City Fair, which had wonderful food. Baltimore, of course, has come into its own now with this kind of food, and it's always been a great neighborhood city. And I think one of the things that happened over the last 10 or 12 years as people have in America have gotten more interested in their home territory, that Baltimore has kind of come into its own because people in Baltimore were always interested in the neighborhood and that and the sort of food that they were used to eating rather than in some kind of artificial food. So I used to think Baltimore was a place, the city in America that if you divided the population by the number of AP datelines, you would come out as the dullest city in America, Baltimore probably. But that's no longer true.
No, I think Kansas City
Kansas City is Kansas City is unfortunately in the news too often. Wichita, of course, wasn't exactly a big city when I was a kid. It's really grown an awful lot and also gotten much more important in the last 20 years. I thought of the next city as Denver from Kansas City, which I think was 600 miles. And which, as you know, slightly south as well as west.
So have you been eating in the Midwest in recent years?
Oh, yes. I
have you ever eaten in Wichita?
Oh, yes. I've been to Wichita. I went to Wichita as part of a story once about the liquor laws in Kansas. When, as you may recall, until the change of a law a few years ago, if you wanted to drink in Kansas, you had to join a club. And, for instance, the bar on top of the Holiday Inn in downtown Wichita looked like a bar and acted like a bar, but what it really was something like the Carousel Club. And you bought what amounted to a share of the liquor pool. You paid them $5, and they weren't allowed to make money on the liquor. They simply had to punch your little card, your $5 card, for whatever a shot of liquor cost every time you ordered a drink. Then they could charge you for the ice and the mix and that sort of thing. And I knew a man who traveled a lot in Kansas who told me that he thought that when he died, the biggest part of his estate would be unused portions of liquor pools and clubs all over Kansas. But I went to Wichita then, and I also went to Wichita years ago when I was doing a piece about the effect of the war in Kansas, and I went back to Newton and North Newton and around there.
They probably eat steak a lot out there.
They do eat steak a lot, and fried chicken, of course, is a kind of a local delicacy.
Chicken Betty and Chicken Annie, I think.
Yes, that's in Crawford County, Kansas. You could drive there from Wichita if you were really hungry, where Chicken Annie and Chicken Betty were having a Chicken Mary, I guess, were having a chicken fried chicken war, although they were deep fryers, and I've always thought that real fried chicken has to be pan-fried. One of the problems is if you pan-fry chicken, it takes a long time. So chicken restaurants, if they're really good, you really have to wait a while. So you pretty much have to go to chicken restaurants with people you're not worried about sitting around for half an hour with waiting for the food.
Why can't they do something like when they make french fries, you know, they can cut the french fry potatoes and boil them until they're almost ready and then put them into the fat. Can they do that? They do that with chicken, don't they, sometimes?
I don't think the real old-timers would do that. I'm not sure about that.
I think
Chicken Betty, I spoke to Chicken Betty after I went to Chicken Annie's and Chicken Mary's. I figured, well, I was pretty close to home anyway. I was down in Crawford County, Kansas, and Kansas City's only a couple hundred miles from there, and also Chicken Betty, at that point in her career, had come to rest at the Metro Auto Auction in either Lee Summit or Raytown, which was a Tuesday auction for where car dealers went to fill out their lots with used cars. They had a little coffee shop, and she was cooking in it. And I talked quite a bit about her, although part of my reason for going to see her is I've been trying to get the Kansas City Chamber of Commerce or City Council, whoever does these things, to rename some things. And I wanted a bridge named after Chicken Betty. I would have had the airport named after her, but I wanted the airport named after Arthur Bryan, the barbecue man. Bryant Field was my idea for the... I think that sounds good for the airport. Certainly sounds better than Kansas City International, which is kind of fanciful anyway, since it's not exactly international.
What would Arthur Bryant do if he had to pay for advertising for his place?
Well, Arthur... Arthur Bryant now has just died over the winter at 80, and the odd thing is, people sometimes say, you must have done a lot for Arthur Bryant's business. I didn't do anything for Arthur Bryant's business. There was a line in front of Arthur Bryant's when I was 14, and there was a line when I went back last fall, a couple months before he died at 80. So he did just fine. I don't think he ever took a nickel's worth of advertising, and everybody always went there.
Who does the cooking in your house?
Well, my one recipe is a special way of cooking scrambled eggs that makes them stick to the pan every time. I do that for breakfast for the girls. We have two daughters before they go to school because I just happen to get up earlier. And I also pack their lunches so that sometimes I say, well, I do breakfast and lunch and my wife does dinner when we eat at home. And I suppose that would be technically true, but not in the spirit of the truth, I think. Actually, my wife is a very good cook, and I can't cook at all. So I kind of chop things sometimes at her direction.
Do you follow the Mimi Sheridan restaurant reviews in the Times?
Oh, sure. We live in the village, so we tend to eat downtown more than uptown. So if it's a restaurant on 75th and 2nd Avenue, I don't usually read on because that's like going to Connecticut for me. I don't basically go to 75th and 2nd Avenue to eat. But sure, if it's a restaurant in the village or in Midtown where I'm likely to have a shot at it in lunch, I read them.
You know the Heavenly Host restaurant on Hudson Street?
Yes, although I haven't been there, and it's really literally a block from my house. But I thought I saw a rental sign on it the other day, so it may have gone. I probably shouldn't say that on the air in case I was wrong. I don't want to keep people away from there. Then I may be wrong. I mean, it may have been on the next store. I was just going by in the car. I know Bert Wolf did a piece on eating in the village for some magazine. I can't remember which one it was. Somebody sent it to me. And said that was an excellent restaurant, I just haven't been in there. There's so many of them around there. There are restaurants that one of them closed that was a block or two from our house. Has been there for 20 years, and I just never quite got around to it. So it was a kind of an embarrassment of riches around there.
Well, Calvin Trillin, we're almost out of time. I want to go back to your book for a minute or two. You had proposed in Third Helpings that... the nature of Thanksgiving dinner be changed. Can you explain that?
Well, it's a campaign. It's a crusade, really. I would like to change the national dish from turkey to spaghetti carbonara. I happen to love spaghetti carbonara, and I admit that I think turkey is something that was invented to punish students for hanging around on Sunday. That's what they serve in the dining halls. But we don't really know what the pilgrims ate, except that it was bound to taste awful. Can you imagine the cooking of English Puritans who thought that anything tasty was probably the work of the devil? And even now, well-brought-up English girls are taught to boil vegetables for a month and a half in case somebody turns up without his teeth. So you can imagine what it was like then. And I think spaghetti carbonara is a likely dish. According to my theory, the Indians actually learned it from Columbus. They didn't call him Columbus, of course. They called him the big Italian fella. And according to my theory, when they were invited to Thanksgiving dinner, they had had some experience with pilgrim cuisine before. So they brought along one dish of their own, and that dish was spaghetti carbonara. The pilgrims, of course, hated it. They said it was sort of thing foreigners ate, heretically tasty, that sort of thing. And when the Indians went back to the village, they were so disgusted that one of them said, what a bunch of turkeys. I think that's where people got the idea that turkey was the original dish, but I think it was actually spaghetti carbonara.
On Thanksgiving Day, do you go out for dinner?
Well, we often go to friends' houses. It's not one of the holidays we do. We find that you have to kind of take your choice of holidays, particularly in New York. There's simply too many holidays to do all of them at home, and we're kind of floaters on Thanksgiving. Finally, one year we weren't invited anyplace. My wife Alice claims that it was because I kept making a pest of myself, saying you shouldn't be serving turkey, you should be serving spaghetti carbonara. And we did have spaghetti carbonara at home, and it was quite a success. I told the girls the story of the first Thanksgiving with spaghetti carbonara, the big Italian fellow, that sort of thing. So I think it's now pretty much of a family tradition, yes.
Makes sense to me. Would you recommend that perhaps from New York City tour buses be established to go to Reading, Pennsylvania, so that people can take a tour of the bars?
Well, I think it would be an uplifting experience for them. I know I did take a tour of the bars, but I went with experts, Suds Krogh and Dregs Donegan, authors of A Beer Drinker's Guide to the Bars of Reading, who were really two scholars after my own heart. I particularly admired the way they had visited 132 bars and written this book and then dedicated it to their wives. I thought there was a certain amount of class shown there. And I think some of what Suds and Dregs call the 5B bars, that is, five beer rating, which I think they defined as a bar that makes the world seem to be a better place than it really is, I think they would certainly be worth a visit to anybody.
Can you imagine busloads of Japanese tourists going into Reading to check out the bars?
Well, oddly enough, I talked to Suds and Dregs the other day. Those aren't their real names, actually, because they're high school teachers, and they took what I refer to in Third Helpings as a nom de bière when they start writing about beer. But they now belong to an organization that actually takes tours of bars, and they had just been to Baltimore, going to, I think, 30 or 40 bars in Baltimore. And I know a friend of mine in Philadelphia belongs to an organization that comes up and does basically a pub crawl of New York. So it's like most of the things we think of as fantasy or too silly to be real actually is happening before our very eyes.
One last question, Calvin Trillin. What is a buffalo chicken wing?
Well, you've asked the right person, since my major scholarly effort was an attempt to do a short history of the buffalo chicken wing. It is the national dish, if buffalo is a nation, of Buffalo, New York, and a fairly new one, invented, I think, 15 years ago, something like that. And it is a chicken wing that is cut into two sections. The part of the chicken wing that looks as if it wasn't supposed to be there to start with is discarded, and I don't know what they do to that, and give it to the Red Cross or something, it's gone. And then cooked, either baked or deep fried, with a certain amount of hot sauce. It looks like a plate full of fried chicken for a midget, a plate full of fried chicken drastically reduced in size, and it's now served all over Buffalo and also in many other places. It is always served, because of a historical accident, with celery and blue cheese dressing. I've never figured out what to do with the blue cheese dressing. I don't think anybody in Buffalo knows, but it's always served that way.
Isn't there some worry about the bones in these wings?
Oh, no, because you have really two pieces when that cutting up is done. One of them is called in Buffalo a drumette. It looks like a tiny drumstick. And the other one looks like a large safety pin. And you just eat it as if you with your hands, as if you're eating fried chicken. It is really quite a delicacy. It is replaced in the hearts of true Buffalonians. It has replaced beef on weck, the previous national dish, which is now still eaten, but not with the gusto of buffalo chicken wings.
Not even a buffalo chicken wing will get me to Buffalo.
Well, it's actually rather very. It's rather a nice city. I met a man when I was up there who thought most of its image problems had been caused by the name Buffalo not being a very Tony name, and so he now pronounces it Buffalo. I think if you say Buffalo, it helps a bit.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.